This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today our show is going to begin with a big issue for North Dakota and lots of Midwest farm states, because we're going to talk about soybeans and other commodities related to the trade war with China with Frayne Olson. He is the NDSU Extension Crops Economist and Marketing Specialist. He's also an Assistant Professor of Agribusiness and Applied Economics. Thank you, Frayne, for joining us today.
Well, I'm glad I could be here.
How did North Dakota become an important soybean-producing state?
Oh, how far back do you want to go?
Well, I know that it's eighth or ninth in
Correct.
Terms of rank in the country, Illinois being number one, Minnesota being number three.
Correct. So it really did evolve out of the growing demand base for soybeans from China. If you go back about 10, almost 15 years now, we started seeing the growth and development of the ethanol industry. And on top of that, we also saw a fairly rapid growth in soybean exports. And the majority of those soybeans are exports going to the Chinese market. And so as the industry started to develop and evolve, there was an incentive to grow soybeans both in the northern and western growing regions. So you go from the Iowa-Illinois kind of Corn Belt region into the Midwest and the northern plains. And part of that was because of our growing conditions and soil types, but a lot of it was because of logistics. It was very simple to get soybeans from North Dakota, South Dakota, even parts of Minnesota, into the West Coast markets, into the large export facilities in the Pacific Northwest.
We've been shipping stuff that way for a long time.
We have been shipping stuff that way for a long time, but this growth and expansion encouraged additional development. So there are more export terminals that came up. The railroads put in additional investment in rail traffic to be able to get the soybeans to the West Coast. And, you know, again, it grew and evolved over time. It wasn't something that happened overnight, but that growth and development then gave the profitability the farmers needed to be able to switch to soybeans and be a major crop in the state.
Well, the trade war is now over a year old, and soybean farmers in farm-producing states have been strategic targets of China, it's fair to say here, I think, because it's a place of support for the current administration. How would you characterize the current circumstances for North Dakota soybean producers because of what's happened?
Extremely uncertain. And we've already seen some of the volatility in prices, again, based off of the information coming out of the trade negotiations. One of the struggles we're having is as we've lost a majority of the soybean market in China, we're looking around the world trying to find additional markets to be able to sell our soybeans into. And it's been a struggle. It really has. And so the challenge we're facing right now is a lot of uncertainty. I know there's a lot of farmers this time last year as we were coming into harvest, the tariffs had been on, big concerns about how many soybeans we're going to be able to sell into the Chinese market. But there was always this hope that, well, a potential deal is just around the corner. You know, we'll just wait a couple more months. We'll see if we get a trade deal. And of course, if the trade negotiations went positive, you know, all of a sudden that Chinese market would open back up and we'd be fine. But obviously, 12 months later, we're still looking at it, and right now negotiations are very slow.
If we were looking at soybean sales in 2017 as 100% sort of a benchmark, where would we be this year to China?
Okay, so and I have the exact numbers. If we look at what we sold to China last year, we sold about 27.7 million metric tons, so 27.7. We're just about to the end of the marketing year now this year for the total count. And we're at about 12.3.
So that's a significant drop.
A significant drop. And again, China being our number one customer.
China is buying from others and investing in other countries to build soybean capacity outside of our country. Do you expect the North Dakota soybean trade with China to return to previous levels?
I really don't. It will take several years for us to rebuild to the levels we saw the last couple of years before the tariffs were in place. And China's, you know, obviously realizing now the dependence they had on the U.S. soybean industry and the soybean market. They have Brazil as a fallback or as an alternative. That's where they're going right now for most of their soybeans. But they've already made some strategic investments saying we've learned a lesson. We need to diversify our sources. We will likely buy from the U.S. if we can get some kind of an agreement in place. but those levels are going to be much lower. So the supply chains throughout the world are actually changing and shifting and evolving right in front of our eyes right now.
And parenthetically, we're watching the Amazon sort of on fire, and a fair amount of the Amazon has been cleared in previous years to accommodate soybean production in Brazil.
A portion of it has. Now, I do want to be a little cautious because the major soybean growing areas and the expansion of Brazilian soybeans has really been in the eastern part of the nation, the northeast, and it's the northwest that is primarily the Amazon area. So there are areas that are being cleared right now, both for lumber and also for cattle, for rangeland. But most of the growth in soybean production has been in the eastward more portions, which is more like our Great Plains were 150 years ago, where it was mainly grassland and brushland.
All right, but China is also expanding port facilities in Brazil to accommodate soybean shipments as well?
They are. They're expanding not only port facilities, they're making investments there, but there's also been a recent agreement or deal between Russia and China.
Mm-hmm.
Southern Russia has, in what we consider the Black Sea region, which would be southern Russia and parts of Ukraine, have very similar growing conditions and soil types to what we have here in the Dakotas and Minnesota.
Germans from Russia.
You know, it's not by accident, right? So their growing conditions and climate are similar, and they have the capacity to grow more corn and soybeans, just like we did. That expansion is now taking place. So China has already signed an agriculture trade agreement with Russia to try and, again, diversify their sources. So it's not just the South Americans in Brazil and Argentina, but also into that Black Sea region. So these are once you make that investment, it's very hard to go back to the old system.
The reason I contacted you about this interview is I saw the recent issue, the August issue of the North Dakota Soybean Grower magazine, and you were highlighted in an article that was headlined Marketing in a New Reality. So we're talking about this new reality now. And you referred to the possibility of the U.S., or likely possibility of the U.S. becoming a residual supplier to China.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a pretty important shift. You know, we always talk about the quantity of bushels, the amount that we sold. But what I'm really concerned about is, are we going to be one of the first calls that China makes to get soybeans, which has been the history, where they call the U.S. and they call Brazil and start haggling over who is the best price? Or are we going to be the residual supplier, where they will call other countries and try and source their soybeans from other countries? If they can't get it someplace else, then the fallback position is the United States. And that has some important implications, not only for grain movements, but also for prices and price volatility.
Well, in the last year, the sale of soybeans to China has fallen by more than half. If you were looking at a crystal ball into next year, what would your future projection be?
You know, again, how are we going to get a trade deal, or aren't we?
Yeah.
And more importantly, it's not just whether we get some kind of an agreement or not. It's also the structure of the agreement. I mean, what kind of terms are we going to have? Now, one of the things leading up to the recent events, China had promised or had at least offered to start buying more U.S. agricultural products, kind of broadly defined. Now, we automatically jumped to, well, that meant soybeans. Well, I think soybeans was part of that mix, but there's a much broader range of agricultural products they're interested in. So, again, is an agreement that we sign going to specify like minimum quantities that they have to buy from us, or is it going to be up to the Chinese businesses and the Chinese government to decide what they want to buy and when they want to buy it? So that's one of the big clouds we have over right now, is just this high level of uncertainty and saying, are we going to get an agreement, and what does that look like?
And it's not just the amount you sell, it's what you sell it for. In the magazine article, you contrasted soybean sales with corn and wheat, commodities that sell the same amount roughly year-round, saying that soybean exports typically run from November through mid-February in terms of the sales peaks. Given the current state of U.S.-China trade negotiations and the availability of soybeans worldwide, what prices should soybean producers expect?
To be very honest, very similar to what we see today. A lot of that information is already kind of bid into the marketplace. The vast majority of the traders and analysts, the people that are buying and selling grain, not only in the futures market but also in the cash market, have that perception. That's kind of the working knowledge we have today. And so unless something changes, I think the shock to the system would be that we get an agreement. I think the status quo right now is we're going to be trading as we are today. So if we do have any sparks in the market, if there's any unexpected changes, it would likely come either in the political side of the line or potentially in the weather. Of course, there's a lot of uncertainty about yields and late plantings and what all that means to
this has been
production.
A tough weather year for the Midwest as well.
It's been a very difficult year for both corn and soybeans. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been a lot of attention on the corn market with late plantings and prevent plant, in particular in the eastern corn belt, but the soybean crop is also vulnerable.
The cover of that magazine, the North Dakota Soybean Grower magazine, showed storage bins along with a delegation, I assume from China, looking at soybeans. They've become very prominent additions to farms in this part of the country. Does that indicate something about supply and demand?
Yes. What has happened, so again, as we saw the growth of soybeans, we also saw an increase in the corn acreage. And I think a lot of the new grain bins that have been put up on farms in the last 5 to 10 years has really been stimulated more by the volumes of corn that's being produced relative to, say, a wheat crop versus a corn crop and being able to store those. But they've now become kind of our safety net, if you will, for the soybean market, that historically farmers would harvest their soybeans and store them for a very short period of time or sell them right at harvest, because that's, again, when the demand base was. So we have this peak load of interest in U.S. soybean sales at harvest or a little after. And then they would store the wheat and they'd store the corn until and market that later on in the season. Well, last year, all that flipped. The farmers were looking at the corn prices and actually the market was incentivizing selling corn at harvest or shortly after. Tremendous incentives to put soybeans in the bin and store it and wait for later delivery. So not only has the trade issues impacted the pricing, but it's also really dramatically shifted the flow of grain and when the market wants that grain delivered. And again, the market is signaling that, where some of those grain bins that were put up for corn are now being used for soybeans.
Frayn Olson is the NDSU Extension Crops Economist and Marketing Specialist and Assistant Professor of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at the university. Has the disruption that was caused by the trade war, and we've lost a big chunk of the biggest market we had, is there a way to supplant that with new relationships like Japan, the European Union? Is there a way to level this out, or is that just hope?
Well, it's going to be challenging. It will be challenging. And let me explain some of the differences. When we think about the corn market or the wheat market, and you look at who we sell those products to, there's a wide range of countries that buy relatively small amounts. So we have a lot of different places that each buy some. But in the soybean market, it's very different. We have one really big customer and then kind of everybody else. The other thing that causes problems is for corn, you can take a corn crop and feed it directly, or it can go from the corn, from the field to a truck to an ethanol plant. But in the case of soybeans, what we're really after is the soybean meal. The soybean meal is the one that has the greatest value for livestock feed. And in China, that would be for feeding their hogs. So you have to process it first. And one of the challenges we have is if we lose that Chinese market, which is the world's largest oilseed crusher, then we need to look around and say, well, who else has crushing capacity to be able to use up these whole soybeans? And that's been the challenge, because number one in the world for crushing is China. Number two is United States. Number three is Brazil. Number four is Argentina. And then finally, after number five, we get to the European Union. Yeah. Well, we're not going to sell soybeans to Brazil and Argentina. They've got enough of their own. So our challenge is to find another home for soybeans with crushing capacity. And that really has been the challenge.
Norman Borlaug, a couple of generations ago, had invented like what we call the Green Revolution with wheat, and we have wheat now grown in India and everywhere. Now we're expanding soybeans in lots of countries, including Russia. So that has something to do with the supply and demand too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And again, I mentioned a little bit earlier about these shifting supply chains. Mm-hmm. Well, that also means that we're going to be looking for new areas to start growing these soybeans. And we're going to have some new level of competition. Now, realistically, it's going to take several years before a new country like, let's say, southern Russia. They've been growing soybeans and corn for a little bit, but it's relatively small acreages. It's going to take them several years to, you know, be able to do it and do it efficiently, to find the right varieties that work in their area. So this is not something that's going to happen in the next 3 or 6 months. But it is a trend, and it's something that I think North Dakota producers need to be concerned about is, all right, how do we stay competitive? What does this new supply chain look like? We will, if we get an agreement, we will be supplying soybeans to China. It's just, what are the levels and when are they going to buy? How do we find these alternative markets? How do we try and develop these new markets in new parts of the world for the products that we're growing?
Well, we've seen farmers make planting decisions that have changed the look of farm fields around us. Is this a process that's likely to be jump-started by what's happening now with soybeans?
I suspect it is. Now, one of the things that I've had many debates and discussions even with some colleagues on, what might this future look like? What are some different scenarios or the most likely scenario? And one of the comments that a colleague made was, well, we've always had these shifts. We've always had these adjustments. And my counterargument is, yes, we have. You know, if you think about driving down a country road, you know, you can keep it between the ditches, but at some point you come to a place where we have to make a decision, do we go left or do we go right? And in my opinion, that's where we're at right now. That's one of the differences we have, is we're all struggling to try to say, well, what is this new direction and how do we make that as efficient as possible?
And we also have, in the meantime, you mentioned this, the transportation for soybeans to the West Coast. That has been affected because there's less of it going there. And we also have farm equipment that is specialized for soybean growth. So these industries are being impacted as well.
Oh, absolutely. And again, we've changed and adjusted our infrastructure for the grain elevators and how the grain elevators handle and manage the crop, how much storage capacity they have versus their ability to load trains very, very quickly. And so these shifts and adjustments are going to take place at many different levels, not only the farm level, but at the elevator level. One of the areas that I do see some potential, it's going to take some time, but I do see some potential, is to be able to export soybean meal instead of exporting raw soybeans. And you know, here in the United States, we have the capacity to be able to crush more soybeans right now. I know there's discussions being had about adding some additional capacity, but that doesn't happen overnight either. And so one of the questions is, well, should we process more of the soybeans that we have within the region and then try and export the meal into some of the newer and developing countries that don't have the crush capacity domestically? You know, Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia are some of those countries that have a growing population. There's an interest in eating more animal protein.
And selling a processed product.
And then selling a processed product instead of the raw soybean. And I know there's a lot of discussion and interest in that, but that doesn't happen overnight. I mean, you have to raise the capital to be able to do that. You have to go through the construction and make sure that the plant is operating efficiently.
Well, besides soybeans, we grow a lot of corn in North Dakota. And as we were talking earlier, that crop has been severely affected by weather, and it's been impacted again by some political decisions. Let's talk about ethanol and that kind of thing. Where's the corn market now?
So the corn market was probably impacted the most recently by some recent USDA reports where the USDA forecast came up with, you know, higher expected yields than I think what the industry was thinking. But added to that, as you suggested, is that there's been some change in policy, some adjustments in how policy has been interpreted, and some of the ethanol ethanol industry has been impacted. So talking about corn just very quickly, the two big uses for corn, the largest use in volume is for animal feed. The second, which is very, very close, is ethanol. Kind of a distant third is exports. So exports are important for corn, but not as important as they are for soybeans. But the ethanol market is a very, very strong market for corn. We got five plants here in the region. These are really important things to our North Dakota economy. The problem is the profit margins have been very thin. Ethanol prices have been falling. We're exporting some ethanol into the Chinese market before all this happened. And so, again, these exports, even though they're relatively small, did have an impact on pricing and pricing opportunities. And the renewable fuel standard – so think about the renewable fuel standard as kind of that floor in the volume that we are required to use. And up until recently, we were producing and selling more ethanol than the requirement was. So the mandate wasn't really binding. It wasn't really – we were hovering above that level. Well, now as some of the plants are closing and some of the exports have been dropping off, that renewable fuel standard now is becoming an important criteria. And the current law has kind of a safety valve embedded in it that allows refineries that were small or adversely impacted by the ethanol requirements, they could get an exemption, so they didn't have to blend as much ethanol. Well, the Trump administration and the way they're operating right now is giving more of these exceptions than they have in the past. And that's effectively lowering this minimum. So the floor that we have is now lower than it was before. And of course, the people in the ethanol industry are very concerned about that because, again, profit margins are very thin right now. And so they're very concerned about making sure that they have a market for the ethanol that's being produced.
There's also been some disruption in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And producers look very intently, I suppose, at what are perceived as planting intentions every year about how many soybeans or how much corn I'm going to grow this year. If you were offering advice, and I'm sure they're desperate to hear some, what would you do? What would you say?
So one of the things, again, just recently, about several weeks ago, USDA came out with a whole series of new reports. I mean, they updated the ones they had, and the shock to the market was the current forecasts were higher production than expected. Well, what I'm telling farmers is, look, the process that USDA uses to make those estimates is a pretty refined process, and they need to stick to the process it's for consistency. Well, that process works really well when we're having kind of a normal year. Well, you know, there's always differences, but if it's a normal year, the process comes pretty accurately. This is not a normal year, and so the process they're using isn't as accurate as it normally would be. So what I'm telling farmers is, look, don't get too worried about what's happening right now. The perception in the market is we're going to have a lot of corn. I'm not convinced that's going to take place. I know there's a lot of end users that are kind of concerned about the size of the crop, and because it's very late. So the concern is if we have even a normal frost, there's going to be damage to the corn crop, damage to the soybean crop. Crop quality is not going to be as good as it usually is. Obviously, not as many bushels will be harvested for grain. There may be more bushels or more acres harvested for corn silage instead.
Well, the bottom line here is that the state's farm economy has had a lean patch for a couple of years now. How much stress is there out there?
Well, the stress is definitely building. And so one of the things we have to be careful of is not to put all farmers in the same bucket. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a very wide range of farming types, farming styles, farming sizes, as well as financial conditions. And you can't always tell by who's driving down the street what kind of financial condition they're in, because there's very large farmers that are doing very well, and there's large farmers that can be struggling financially, as well as small farmers. So size isn't really a good indicator. Age isn't really a good indicator. We can't be too generalistic about this. So there are some farmers that have been doing okay. The yields have been above average. They've been doing a good job of marketing. They've got a very solid cost structure, so they know where they're at. And then there's others that are really struggling. And so there's a lot of attention paid to the folks that are struggling, as there should be. In talking to lenders and visiting with them, they're also being having a greater concern that we're starting to see more and more of these farmers slipping into that kind of the red zone for financial condition. They don't have the financial reserves to be able to take another major downturn. I think we're going to lose some farmers this winter. I would not be surprised at that. The question is, how big is this exodus going to be? And there's a lot of debate about that. I think, again, verdict is still out until we know what kind of yields we get.
Well, it's been an interesting year, and we thank you for sharing your expertise with us today.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. It's always fun to visit.
Frayn Olson is an NDSU Extension Crops Economist and Marketing Specialist and Assistant Professor of Agribusiness and Applied Economics.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, realtor and broker with Hatch Realty, serving home buyers and sellers in the Fargo-Moorhead Metro, Grand Forks, Bismarck-Mandan, and Detroit Lakes area. Josh can be reached at 701-369-4839 or hatchrealty.com. Heritage Education Commission, in partnership with Moorhead Community Education, presents the 44th Annual Family History Workshop, Saturday, September 28th, from 8 a.m. to 4:15 p.m. at Horizon Middle School in Moorhead, Minnesota. Offering 20 classes by expert presenters for all skill levels, novice to professional, including main presenter Alice Hoyt-Veen, genealogist, professional researcher, and educator. Information and registration at heritageed.com.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. This is the second Sunday of the month, when our late afternoon schedule includes Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life with host Jack Russell Weinstein. Jack is a professor of philosophy at the University of North Dakota, and his monthly public radio show has covered a wide range of provocative topics with discussions that feature experts from around the country and the world. Every month, we preview the new topic with Jack, and the show later today is titled, Why Do We Need a New Translation of the Hebrew Bible?
Well, I guess it doesn't get any bigger than this, does it? We take this book for granted. We tend to think of the Hebrew Bible as identical to the Old Testament. We tend to think of it as settled debate. Well, there was the King James, or there was the volume that I used in my church or synagogue, right? But there's massive amounts of biblical scholarship coming up, and this guy, Robert Alter, is probably the most influential biblical scholar alive, and he has just come out with the final volume of the complete Hebrew Bible, which he translated on his own. I have the three volumes in the box on my shelf, and it's something beautiful to look at, let alone to read.
He's an American professor of Hebrew and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley. He's taught there since 1967.
Let's not talk about that, shall we?
That's amazing. So let's get a basic question here first before we delve into his translation and the whole issue of translating Bibles. How is theology distinct from philosophy?
Well, that's a very good question. And actually, they used to say that religion is the handmaiden of philosophy. And what that means is that philosophy asks the big questions and philosophy tries to explain the world as it is. Religion tries to take some of those big questions and impart them given particular ideologies or particular disciplines or particular ways of thinking. And so a Catholic priest wants to recount the Catholic point of view. We hope that the Catholic priest reads the newspaper and knows other religions and has a wide-ranging, sophisticated outlook in the world. But the priest is a representative of that religion. And so religion is a cultural product that combines meaning, ideology, and ritual, tells us how to live and how to behave in particular ways. Philosophy is a field of study that tries to seek the truth in all other disciplines. So there's a philosophy of religion, for example, just like there's a philosophy of music or a philosophy of art.
What is faith to a philosopher?
That is a huge question, and I'm not sure that I'm willing to answer that. Faith is a matter of great debate amongst philosophers. So you get someone like Kierkegaard who thinks that faith is about the expression of free will and the ability to choose not only your own fate but your own meaning. But then you get someone like Freud who says that faith is the loss we have of our parents, and that what we really want is just an all-powerful father figure to protect us. So as far as philosophy is concerned, every answer in the book is faith.
Well, let's deal with this new translation, 2018, of the Hebrew Bible. How does the Hebrew Bible differ from the Old Testament?
Well, they differ in very important ways, actually. They have a different number of books. They're in a different order. They're grouped differently. The translations are different, including much of the Old Testament is sometimes based on some Greek instead of the Hebrew. But the biggest difference for my mind is that the Old Testament is written with an eye toward the coming of Christ. Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, is said to prefigure Christ. It anticipates it. But the Hebrew scripture doesn't do that because as far as the Hebrews were concerned, as far as Jews are concerned, Christ wasn't the Messiah and the book isn't talking about that. So the Hebrew Bible is read differently because it's not read with an eye towards this other story. It's more open-ended. It's more ambiguous. It doesn't have a very obvious trajectory.
What was the initial purpose of the Hebrew Bible? Why was it written?
Well, it was first compiled rather than written. So there were a lot of different pieces that were oral histories and oral stories. There were texts that were politically motivated. And so at a certain point in time, people started taking these oral traditions and putting them together. But how they put them together was a product of their own time and their own politics. So the things they wanted to emphasize or de-emphasize changed over time. So what you end up getting and what we call the Hebrew Bible is actually an interweaving of a bunch of different sources. So very famously, there's an editor called J, right? And certain verses are J verses. And then there's what's called P or the priestly source. And that's different versions. You know, there are two stories of creation, right, in the Bible. And they're not there because someone decided to say it twice. They're there because there were different sources that then were put together in a very important way that gives new insight. So anytime you see repetition in the Bible, it is often the case that it's a different source. Now, let me say, what I'm describing is the anthropological and literary account of the Bible. There are people who believe that the Bible was handed down word for word by God, that it is a revelation that is absolutely true. Some Orthodox Jews believe that the first books, five books of Moses were written by Moses himself. Those are personal choices and personal beliefs, a matter of faith. But for a philosopher and for a conversation with a translator, we approach the Bible in the anthropological sense in that we look at the evidence as to how and when it was put it together and why.
Well, was the initial purpose of the Hebrew Bible when it was compiled and assembled and ultimately written down in a linear narrative form, was it considered to be a collection, a compilation of sacred text, or literature?
I don't know that we can divide the question in that way. So let me give an analogous example. Is the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel a sacred work of art, or is it just a work of art?
It's a commissioned work of art.
It's a commissioned work of art that had sacred motivation. And so I think that the original Hebrew Bible was motivated for religious reasons. It was motivated for political reasons, and it was motivated for literary reasons. Look, when the Cathedral of Notre Dame was being built and they built all the gargoyles, they put all the gargoyles, there are religious reasons for that. It's to scare out spirits, to remind people about morality. But it's also all the artists were allowed to do. There were huge periods of time where artists were only allowed to paint or write about religion. So the most creative people in the world would express that creativity through religious imagery. It doesn't mean they believed less. It doesn't mean that they weren't genuinely respectful of the ideas. It was just the only thing they were allowed to do. And I think that when the Hebrew scripture was being put together, there was a lot of that going on. The smartest people, the most educated people, the most literarily motivated people were themselves in religious orders. They were rabbis. They were priests. They were monks. And so all of the great art for a huge period of human history is religious because that's the only place that creativity was permitted and it was the central motivator in people's lives.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life, heard at 5 Central on this Sunday on the Prairie Public Radio Network. How old is the first iteration of the Hebrew Bible?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
A couple of thousand years?
It's a couple of thousand years. The oral traditions are probably more like 5-6 thousand years. And then when it becomes compiled, That's a bit later. There isn't a Hebrew scripture, say, in the year zero, mm-hmm. right? When Jesus was walking the earth, whether he was divine or not, and there were Jews, they didn't have the Hebrew Bible. They had stories. They had rituals. And so it isn't until much later that the book that we think of begins to look the way that it does.
And who was it written for?
Well, again,
because not everybody, there was no Gutenberg press.
Well, no, there was no Gutenberg press. So for example, the way that Bibles were reproduced was by hand, that you would have monks in the Christian tradition and rabbis and scribes in the Jewish tradition, where they would have a version of the Bible on you know, one side of their table, and they would be writing out by hand on scrolls, on parchment, the other. And so they were incredibly expensive to make. They were incredibly time-consuming. And even today, in synagogues, Jews all pray using a Torah scroll, the first five books of Moses, on parchment, wrapped up like a scroll. And those, I will tell you, are very, very expensive. So who it's for depends on the context, who had access to it, and who was writing it. And ultimately, the skeptic in me, if I'm allowed to say this, will say that ultimately the Bible was written by people in power to stay in power. But that doesn't mean that the divine message, if you believe in that sort of thing, doesn't come through, because God can work through greedy people and powerful people as well as the most generous and altruistic people.
Well, in the 21st century, the reading audience has changed.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
And so maybe that's one argument for a translation.
I think that's right. I think that one of the wonders of a translation like this is it is, at least in theory, accessible to everybody, right? There is no priestly class that has exclusive rights to this book. If you can afford it, you can buy it. If you have a local library, you can borrow it. If you have a friend, you can read it at their house if you can't afford it yourself. And no one is going to punish you, and no one is going to arrest you, and no one is going to accuse you for reading it. We live in a time where more people have more access to this sort of thing than any other period in history, and that's pretty amazing.
Well, you just touched on this a moment ago, and I want to just delve into it a little deeper. Bibles were first created as a form of social organization and governance, weren't they?
That's absolutely right. Certainly, the history of the West, of Western Europe, is one where religion and the government are identical in many respects, right? Popes were military leaders. Popes had allegiances with kings. And so what the Bible did was give people a gathering point, a collection of common texts. Now, you mentioned before the Gutenberg Bible, right? Most people couldn't read Hebrew. Most people couldn't read Latin. Most people couldn't read German when they were German. And so the stories that we think of coming from the Bible were, if they were ever presented, were presented in verbal abridgments. They were told to other people. Remember, again, for Catholics, for a millennia and a half, the rituals were all done in Latin, and the peasants didn't speak Latin. So they would go to church, and this stuff was going on, and they would have no idea what was going on. So what the Bible became was the core organizing factor of a particular religion, whether it's the Jewish religion or the Christian religion. And then it becomes the thing that all the stuff justifies itself by citing, and a record of history and a record of people that allows us to preserve it over time.
Well, when you organize thousands of people to go march to their death according to something that's written in the Bible, that's sort of a dogma being presented as religious leaders, being presented by religious leaders as a form of erasing individuality, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. And now you're being the skeptic, right?
Yes.
In the sense that, right, the history of religion is absolutely a history of warfare. And one of the great threads of religion is the question of individuality. If you look at the Hebrew Bible, there is no individual revelation in the Hebrew Bible. Everything that Israel learns from God, Israel learns collectively. I mean, you have these conversations between Moses and God and Abraham and God, but the Hebrews, the Israelites, they all learn things as a group. It isn't until frankly, the Enlightenment, the 18th century, where our idea of individuality and our idea of the dignity of the person becomes recognized, let alone believed. That isn't in the Bible. And when we read that sort of thing through the Bible, it's anachronistic. It's not accurate. It's not representative of the way that people thought.
So this gets to another big question. Is there sacred scripture? Is a certain grouping of words sacred?
Well, that depends what you mean by sacred, the philosopher says. Because
you.
The answer is yes, there's sacred scripture because people who are in charge say this is sacred. They say the Book of Moses is sacred. They say the Bhagavad Gita is sacred. They say the Quran is sacred. It's sacred because it's sacred. Do you mean, however, are there texts that can't be challenged, that can't be questioned, that can't be modified, that can't be played with? Well, that's a religious and political decision that depends on the context and depends on the nation. So, right, ISIS, right, thinks that there are parts of the Quran that should never be doubted or questioned in any way, shape, or form. There are other fundamentalists in every religion that believe that some form of questioning or some form of doubt is inappropriate. The Hebrew Bible is special in the sense that Judaism has always felt that questioning and investigating the Bible is permissible. I once read this tome on blasphemy. It was like 700 pages. And the first chapter was on Judaism, and it said, the only form of blasphemy in Judaism is using God's name to curse God's God. And I thought that was incredibly interesting. So you can doubt God in Judaism. You can doubt the legitimacy of the text. You can doubt the divinity, but you still have to do what you need to do. So sacred is what the people in power say it is, but in the modern world, there's nothing sacred in the sense that there's nothing that's off limits.
Well, Robert Alter, as we've been talking, is a Hebrew scholar and a comparative literature professor and written this new book, a new translation, not a new book, but a new translation of the Hebrew Bible, a very old book. Doesn't this give the translator, if you will, a kind of divinity?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because when people talk about the King James Bible, which is probably the most popular translation, they often talk about it as being divinely inspired. There is an aura about the King James Bible that suggests that God worked through the translators. Robert says that there were about 40 of them. That is not Robert's point of view. Robert sees himself as a professor and a scholar and a translator. And he went from Genesis 1:1 all the way through and did the best job he could to look at the original language and not just offer an accurate interpretation of the language, but try to preserve the rhythm of the original Hebrew, the music, as he says, of the original Hebrew, the metaphors of the original Hebrew. One of the things he says is that one of the problems with all modern translations is that they give up on these metaphors and these give up on this rhythm in order to explain the Bible. They want things to be crystal clear to the lay reader, but that loses all of the magic of the literary aspect of it. They're not interested in the beauty of the English language. They're only interested in the message. Robert is very concerned with the beauty of the language itself, of finding rhythm, finding sounds, finding music that he can move from the Hebrew to the English so that the Bible can be heard to be beautiful in the way that it was originally in Hebrew. The Hebrew Bible was written to be listened to. It wasn't written to be read. And most Bibles we listen to, they're not poetic literary events. They're something else. And Robert is trying to preserve that and to return to this idea that language is important. And he actually says that the closest thing to what he wants is the King James Bible, but there are, of course, radical differences that are important.
And, of course, the King James Bible has many – it has verses, it has poetry, it has, as you mentioned, metaphor and allegory. These are literary terms and devices.
That's absolutely right. And it's also Christological, meaning it's written – with an eye towards the Christ story. So a Jew who is worshiping cannot use the King James Bible because it's a different religion and it's a different context. So we have poetry, we have drama, we have history, we have meaning, we have beautiful language. We have all these things wrapped up in this one book, and Robert is trying to give the most authentic and beautiful account while remaining true to the original text.
Well, this gets us back to kind of where we started here. If you're talking about something that was oral history thousands of years ago, maybe written down a couple of thousand years ago or compiled and evolved to what it is today, once it's been translated into another language, and maybe more than once, and since the context of the times is continually evolving, how confident can we be that the document that we call the Hebrew Bible in the 21st century is representative of what it was when it was originated?
Well, I don't think any scholar is going to say that the Bible as we have now is largely the same thing as it was when it was first put together. What ends up happening is that over periods of time, things are added, things are taken away. There are, not to talk about, to move again away from the Hebrew Bible, there are gospels other than the four gospels that are part of the canonical New Testament. They just aren't generally accepted as legitimate by the Catholic Church. And so what we have now is very different than what first started, but there's a point, and I'm sorry to say I don't know when that is, but there's a point where biblical scholars say, okay, this is the text that we're going to regard as definitive. This is where the putting together is pretty much done, and everything after is just a modification. And how confident can we be that what we have in Hebrew now is accurate duplication of what we had then? That's what biblical scholars do for a living, right? They try to figure out the answer to that. I'm not qualified to say, but certainly there are things that people are pretty confident are original, and then there are things that people are pretty confident are addenda.
Well, don't the written and translated foundations of religion underscore a conundrum here? How much of God is man-made?
Again, it depends who you ask, right? In the sense that, look, so I'm going to sound like a philosopher here for a second.
Good.
I want to distinguish between two things, big words, metaphysics and epistemology. Metaphysics is the nature of reality. It's the study of nature of reality. Epistemology is the study of how we know things, the study of knowledge. So metaphysics tells us there is or there is not a God. Epistemology tells us we can know there's a God or we don't know there's a God. So we've got four options. There's a God and we know it. There's a God and we don't know it. There isn't a God and we know it. And there isn't a God and we don't know it, right? That's the philosopher answer. And philosophers have differed radically on their position on all four of those things. Different religions differ radically on those four things. One of the key elements why faith – you brought up faith earlier – one of the key elements why faith is so important is that many religions believe that you can't know for certain that there's a God or not. So faith becomes the central tenet. And so how much of God is in the text, how much of God is in religion, that's a personal decision. Scholars fight about it constantly.
Well, your subject this Sunday is Why Do We Need a New Translation of the Hebrew Bible? It features Robert Alter. Why do you think his translation is an important work?
The first and most simplest answer is it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. I read Genesis like a novel from beginning to end, and it was, pardon the term, miraculous. It brings a new life and a new attention not only to the language but to the details. It let me see things that I never saw before and allowed me to think about things in a different way. So that's the first aspect. It's just beautiful. The second is it's consistent. He has tried to remain consistent in his method and his language from the very beginning of the Hebrew Scriptures to the very end. It's also non-denominational and non-political. And what I mean by that is, yes, it is written from a Hebrew perspective, but he is not an Orthodox Jew espousing Orthodox Jewish positions, just like he's not a conservative Catholic or a liberal Catholic doing the same thing. He is doing as best as he can as a professor of literature and a professor of Hebrew of going to the original text and trying to get the best language that reflects the original Hebrew. So the task is not theological, it's literary.
Jack Russell Weinstein, the host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. You can hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on the Prairie Public Radio Network. Jack, as usual, thank you very much for your insights.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and this is a deep one.
Okay.
Here's Chuck Lura from Dakota College at Botano with Natural North Dakota.
Have you ever noticed a trunk of a tree with several horizontal rows of rather small and shallow oval-shaped holes in the bark? I suspect that many among us have, but probably do not know the cause. It's the work of yellow-bellied sapsuckers, a type of woodpecker. Yellow-bellied sapsuckers are about 8 to 9 inches long. That's larger than a downy woodpecker, but close to that of a hairy. As the name implies, they have a noticeably yellow-tinged belly. Males have a bright red crown and throat, black mottled back, white wing patch, and a black and white stripe from near the beak and eye that curves down to the neck. Like many other birds, the females and juveniles are less colorful. The term sapsucker is no misnomer. They do suck sap. The telltale sign of sapsuckers is the horizontal lines of small oval holes in bark. Unlike most woodpeckers that hammer away on trees to get at insects, sapsuckers excavate small shallow holes in the bark to get at the sap, which they lick up as it oozes from the holes. Because a tree's phloem or sugar-conducting tissue tends to clog up above the holes, the sapsuckers will often excavate another line of holes above the pre-existing holes to get even more sap. Sugar maple, birch, scotch pine, and aspen with heartrot are known to be preferred trees for these birds. They'll revisit the flowing sap periodically, and that flowing sap attracts other birds, including woodpeckers, hummingbirds, warblers, and nuthatches. Porcupines, squirrels, and bats are also known to exploit the running sap. The breeding range of yellow-bellied sapsuckers is roughly the coniferous forests of the northern U.S. and Canada. They're migratory, spending their winters in the southeast United States and Central America. As such, they're summer residents in our state, mainly north and east of the Missouri River. They're quite common in the Turtle Mountains, Pembina Hills, Devil's Lake area, and timbered bottomlands of the Cheyenne and Red River and their tributaries. If you're not familiar with the sapsucker's excavations, you may have heard them drumming. Yellow-bellied sapsuckers are known for their fondness for tapping out their territorial calls on metal surfaces. Eave troughs, flashing on roofs, as well as ridge roll are big hits with sapsuckers. We used to see and hear one frequently hammering away on an aluminum stepladder in our backyard. The hammering has stopped for now. Maybe they found the love of their life elsewhere. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botano. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it with you.
Dallas.
Des Moines.
Topeka.
Montana.
Cleveland.
San Francisco.
Denver.
Philadelphia.
Minneapolis.
Miami.
Colorado.
Washington.
You will own your morning, wherever you are, when you choose to spend tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Beginning at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.